There was no good reason for Peter to be in Caesarea. More properly known as Caesarea Maritima, it was a coastal city built by King Herod, and it was built to be the local seat for the Roman occupation. Within the bounds of Judea, you could not find yourself in a more Roman and Gentile space. And so this is the context for Peter's speech we heard in the Acts of the Apostles. It's almost like it was given behind enemy lines. Right? Peter, being a devout Jew, had no business being there. And then to be in a Gentile's house, this meant instant ritual defilement. And yet here Peter stands in the home of a Roman centurion of the Italian cohort. Peter seems to be a fisherman out of his local waters. And so here are his words. "You yourselves know that it is unlawful for a Jew to associate with or to visit a Gentile. But God has shown me that I should not call anyone profane or unclean. So when I was sent for, I came without objection. Now, may I ask, why did you send for me?" Essentially, Peter is saying, you and I both know that I should not be here, but you sent and I came. Now, can anyone tell me why I'm here? Do you begin to sense how out of the ordinary our scene in this reading just might be? I mean, there were scores of synagogues to visit. The church throughout Judea and the Galilee and Samaria was thriving, we are told earlier in the Acts of the Apostles. And yet Peter has risked all that he knows to be holy by entering the home of a Gentile and a Roman centurion for God's sake, all without knowing the reason. Why on earth would Peter do this? And why on this day we celebrate Jesus' baptism, why are we hearing this story? Well, once again, context is critical. And some here today may remember the backstory that leads us to this reading from the Acts of the Apostles this morning, but for those who might not, I will try the condensed version. At the beginning of chapter 10, we are told of a centurion named Cornelius, who, even though he is a Gentile, is known by many to be both devout and generous. And one afternoon, while he is at prayer, Cornelius has a vision, and in front of him stands a dazzling figure who tells him that his prayers have been heard by God and that Cornelius is to send for a certain Simon who is called Peter in Joppa. So immediately he sends two slaves and a devout soldier to search in nearby Joppa for this Peter. And at the same time as that is happening, in Joppa, where Peter is staying, he is praying, and he falls into a trance and has this vision. And in this radical vision, he sees something like a sheet being lowered from the heaven. And on this sheet are all kinds of animals that Peter and all practicing Jews know to be unclean. Not just unadvisable because they are a bit gamey, but unclean as in they are out of bounds for you if you want to be a member of your people. But a voice in the vision says, "Get up, Peter, kill and eat." But Peter refuses. "By no means, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is profane or unclean." Sounds like Peter, all right. A back and forth ensues until the voice says to Peter, "What God has made clean, you must not call profane." What God has made clean, you must not call profane. Well, as our story would have it, just as Peter is trying to make heads or tails of this vision, Cornelius's men arrive at the gate of the home where Peter is staying. And while he is still dazed by this vision, Peter is again visited and told by the Spirit that there are men looking for him and that he is to go with them, which he does. He goes downstairs, the men are there, and sight unseen, he follows and is led to Caesarea, into this centurion's home. And when he arrives, he finds that all of Cornelius's family and his closest friends have gathered, and they are all waiting for this holy man, Peter. Now let's just pause here and remember that as best we know, Peter was a fisherman. He had not been formally trained or educated in rhetoric like his soon-to-be compatriot Paul. And that in the Gospels, he's not always the one who gives the right answer on the first try. And yet here he is, placed in the living room of one of the more powerful foreigners in the region, a centurion. And they're waiting. Can you imagine? So he politely asks Cornelius, "Why am I here again?" It's like Peter has been following all along intuitively. He's been listening and he's been led, but he's not quite sure where all of this is headed, which I can identify with. He has a sense for what is happening, but it's a limited one, and it's when Cornelius tells his own story about seeing in a vision that he is to send for Peter in the home of this tanner Simon. It's then that it begins to take shape for Peter. And then Cornelius finishes with this sentence. "So now all of us are here in the presence of God to listen to all the Lord has commanded you to say." But no pressure. But, you know, I actually wonder if any pressure was felt, because it seems to me that it is in that moment that it all falls into place for Peter. Why he has had this vision, why he was summoned to this centurion, why all these Gentiles are waiting for what he has to say. All of a sudden, he knew. And I can only imagine that he began speaking with great passion and emotion, because this is Peter, after all. And so this is what has led us up to today's reading. This is what precedes Peter's words, and we need to know it in order to hear his words again. And so I'll read again, this time from the paraphrase called The Message. Peter says, "It's God's own truth. Nothing could be plainer. God plays no favorites. It makes no difference who you are or where you're from. If you want God and are ready to do as He says, the door is open. The message He sent to the children of Israel that through Jesus Christ everything is being put together again, well, He's doing it everywhere among everyone." We come here every week, some of us all our lives. We come through this font and to this table. And why? Why here, of all places in Berkeley, California, where there is little to negative social benefit? Why have we come? Well, this week, in entering the stories of Peter and Cornelius and of Jesus and John at the River Jordan, we come to remember. We gather today to remember who and whose we are. In a world that prospers when division reigns, we come to remember that God takes the part of all without restriction. Coasts or heartland, red or blue, Dinka or Nuer, Palestinian or Israeli, the world in which we live, especially of empire and of multinational, divides in order to conquer. For us as Christians in the 21st century, Peter's vision of what we shall not call profane should be as radical today as it was in Cornelius' home nearly 2,000 years ago. Radical in that it stretches back to the roots of covenant. Radical in that a lack of partiality does not mean neutrality, like God can't decide who to root for, so God is sitting this one out. Radical, because not showing partiality means that God refuses to choose only one people. Radical, because we come to remember that we have been claimed. All of us. So this is why on Sundays like this one, when we celebrate baptism, we scoop up holy water and we send it skyward as if our lives depend upon it. Right? Because this sprinkling is to help us to remember. Remember where we have been, who and whose we are. That we have been shown to be beloved of God, marked with delight. And because, and I may be alone in this, friends, but in the fierce competition that is being waged every day for my time, my attention, my money, my loyalty, my just about everything, in this life it is far too easy for me to forget that I am beloved of God, that you are beloved of God, that those that I most decidedly disagree with are beloved of God, saint and tyrant alike. This does not mean that our actions do not matter. They do. But it means that we come to remember that God does not play favorites, even as I wish sometimes that God would, as long as I get to choose the side. And friends, I have to say that I get tired of forgetting whose I am. Time and time and time again, I weary myself by withholding for fear of little return. Does this sound familiar? Soon we will turn our attention to our baptismal vows, to a statement of trust, and to questions of faith, and then to prayers, the table, and dismissal. And we will walk out these copper doors yet again into a world that is often indifferent and sometimes even hostile when offered grace and mercy, forgiveness, and reconciliation. And if my experience serves me, sometime this week we will be faced with a choice. And so I wonder, whether it is Wednesday morning or Friday night, will our remembrance of this morning and whose we are, will it remain? When push comes to shove, when envy or hatred or greed or fear rise up among us or rise up within us, how will we choose to respond? If God truly shows no partiality, if God plays no favorites, are we ready to receive this gift as beloved in order that we offer it without condition to others in return.